everyone. I'm Gary Nall. We're here to empower people calmly, with reason, good science, common sense, and most importantly, your own personal experience. We're going to talk about zinc, what it does to the brain, how soybeans can protect postmenopausal women, how eating a high-fat diet will reprogram your immune cells. Coenzyme Q10 reverses cholesterol transport, and a study confirms processed foods the key to rising obesity, and also violence on television. The effects from age 3 can stretch for a long time in a young teen's life. And then we have a very important commentary. I worked all night on this one, and I'm going to share it with you. It's about the human condition today. Hopefully, you will find that it answers a lot of questions about why people are not being more proactive and taking responsibility for the choices they or people they've assigned to be responsible for them in their lives. So, new insights today. And it will be posted on GaryNall.com. But first, we begin with how zinc is associated with the higher levels of brain growth factor. This is from the University of Medical Sciences. In a review and a meta-analysis of randomized controlled trials, said yes, there is an association between supplementing with zinc and higher circulating levels of brain-derived neurotrophic factor, or what is called BDNF. And it plays a very positive role in the survival of brain cells known as neurons. And a reduction in this BDNF expression occurs in Alzheimer's and Parkinson's, multiple sclerosis, and ALS. So antidepressants and anthocyanin supplements have been shown to increase the BDNF gene expression. And so that's good news, especially the omega-3 fatty acids, resveratrol, and zinc. Now, I'm not an advocate of the antidepressants, because anytime you see these studies, if you look at that little kind of gray lettering that's hard to read and you don't pay attention to when they're telling all the toxic side effects of a medication, you'll see that this drug, along with a healthy diet and exercise, well, did they actually do 3 studies? The drug against exercise, the drug against diet, and the diet and exercise together without the drug. No, they didn't do any of the above. So therefore, I'm going to say the anthocyanins, and that's a lot of your fruits, and the omega-3 fatty acids, resveratrol, and zinc is what I would use. So just something good that helps people with brain conditions. We have a lot of people suffering from brain conditions. We also have a lot of postmenopausal women suffering with osteoporosis. New study from the University of Hull, which is in the United Kingdom, talks about soybeans. And of course, whenever possible, use the organic soybeans. But eating a diet rich in both soy protein and isoflavones can protect menopausal women from bone weakening and osteoporosis, according to the results of this study presented at the Society for Endocrinology at their annual meeting in Edinburgh. Now, soybeans contain what are called isoflavones, F-L-A-V-O-N-E-S. Now, these are similar in structure to estrogen, and so could theoretically protect women against osteoporosis by mimicking the action of estrogen. But they're non-carcinogenic, where a lot of estrogen, including meat, is carcinogenic. That's one of the reasons that even if you've consumed meat up to menopause, get off of it. What are the 3 primary drivers of estrogen in a woman's body? Stress, animal proteins, and high-fat diets. Those are the big ones. So we're in lack of exercise. So try the soy protein, because it contains 66 milligrams of isoflavones, or just take a supplement. And in this study, when it was just soy protein alone for 6 months, it worked. So just another way that we can help ourselves, another piece of the puzzle. Now, a study finds that a diet high in saturated fat can reprogram your immune cells. This is from Portland State University. This is a brand new study, and it showed that the researchers found that eating a diet exclusively high in saturated fats can reprogram the mouse's immune system. And so you have to ask yourself, when people are on these high-fat diets, what's it doing to them? And what's it doing to their biochemistry? These are common in the ketogenic or keto diet, popular, and I do not recommend it. And in any case, I suggest that you look at a plant-based diet, that when you do eat fats, you're eating fats that are healthy fats from walnuts or almonds or pistachios or macadamia nuts. And avocados are very good fat. And coconut oil is good fat. And flaxseed oil, hemp seed oil, are rich in the omega-3 fatty acids. So those are good fats. Those are the fats we should be putting into our body. Not animal fats, because animal fats are also very pro-inflammatory, because they are used as a particular type of acid in the body, and that's pro-inflammatory, not good. Arachidonic acid. Now, when it comes to coenzyme Q10, I definitely recommend it, because it's in all of our cells, it's what produces energy. But a new study shows that when you take coenzyme Q10, which diminishes over time, that's why supplementation is important, it reverses cholesterol transport. This is from Sun Yat-sen University in Taiwan. So according to the report, they found that coenzyme Q10 enhances macrophage reverse cholesterol transport via an activator protein, which means you have better control over your cholesterol. It's that relatively straightforward and simple. Next up, a study confirms that processed foods is the key to rising obesity. University of Sydney, which of course is in Australia. This was a year-long study of the diet habits of 9,341 Australians, and it's back growing evidence that highly processed and refined foods are the leading contributor of rising obesity rates in the Western world. And with that, of course, comes heart disease, strokes, cancer, depression, along with it, and also non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, which can kill you. This was done at the University School of Life and Environmental Sciences. And so it's important, wean yourself away. And if you do, if you really get off that diet, and you begin to get good fibers and good quality plant proteins and lots of fresh juices, organic foods wherever possible, hopefully locally grown, then you can add years onto your life. Otherwise, our life expectancy is declining precipitously. And finally, violence on television. Well, this study from the University of Montreal shows that watching violent TV during preschool years can lead to later risks of psychological and academic impairment by summer before middle school starts. So it doesn't take a whole lot of time of watching this, and the games that now they have, these PlayStation games, which are extremely violent. And according to Professor Pagnia at the University School of Psychoeducation, before now, it was unclear to what extent exposure to typical violent screen content in early childhood, a particularly critical time in brain development, can predict later psychological distress and academic risks. So the detection of early modifiable factors that influence a child's later well-being is an important target for individual and community health initiatives. But then ask yourself, which community in the United States will inform parents and teachers that children, young children watching these, are not able to process at the intellectual level, but they do process it epigenetically at the emotional level. So if they see that getting angry is a good outcome for an argument. And if the violence that then occurs along with that anger is justifiable in the realms to which they are watching, and that's not good. So that's something that we're not dealing with as a society. We're not dealing with how bad television and these games are to development of a child's psychological well-being. That's the latest on health and healing. We're going to take a break, come back, and I have a special commentary for you that hopefully will give you a better understanding of why we're in the problems we are today and what is the likely outcome from being in this situation. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. I'm Gary Naughan. I'd like to welcome you from all over the world if you're listening to this program. If you find that what I'm sharing is resonating with you on different levels, please share it with other people. Word of mouth is very powerful today, especially since virtually all of the main internet sites, Facebook and YouTube, they're censoring this information. Today's commentary is entitled, Will America's Future Be Utopian or Dystopian? As Americans make their choices in the contentious midterm elections, the population is confused and angry. Public trust in the mainstream media's narrative about the state of the union is abysmal. 40% of Americans wake up each morning uncertain whether they can be able to make ends meet amidst the heated dialectical skirmishes between competing political ideologies. The majority of Americans no longer know who or what to believe. The penetration of woke anger throughout the halls of Washington and university campuses and news networks have turned otherwise civil discourse into renewed racist vitriol. The very term racism is losing its relevant meaning, which in the past was based upon historical facts. Critical thought is further being suppressed by bombardment of various forms of indoctrination. Accept the growing numbers of genders, or be canceled. Get vaccinated or else. The freedom to make personal medical choices for one's own body and health are being stripped away and replaced by the choice of complying with mandatory medical interventions or losing a job and becoming a member of a marginalized apartheid class. Whenever the official playbook is challenged, the critics will be attacked. Not infrequently, they will have their reputations destroyed by the new cancel culture. It is no longer acceptable to voice a difference of opinion about the dishonest power structures. The brutal shakedown and flattening of two centuries of American cultural development, including the trends that made the U.S. the world's most ethnically diverse nation, has transformed the country into a morally decrepit wasteland. The intelligence agencies, the CIA, the National Security Agency, Homeland Security, and their NGOs, non-governmental organizations, wielding power over their captured media and university administrations, and the Silicon Valley tech giants have adopted a take-no-prisoner policy. On college campuses, woke students are usurping curriculums and grading. If you don't like math, just say it's racist and you don't have to take a math course and you'll still get passed. They demand to be the final arbiters that determine whether a professor should be fired or not. When Portland State University professor of philosophy, Peter Boghossian, spoke out against the woke orthodoxy that hijacked the campus, he started to invite a variety of speakers to offer alternative views. The outcome? Well, quote, digital vigilantes infiltrated his social media accounts, calling him a bigot and a Nazi, and contacting old friends in search of dirt, end quote. Other examples include John Stanton, a distinguished professor emeritus in neuroscience at Duke University, who was removed from the American Psychological Association's discussion group. What did he do? What was so harmful? Well, he held the view that there are only two sexes. Charles Nagy, a 22-year tenured psychology professor at the University of Central Florida, was fired for criticizing woke ideas about racism and white privilege. And the dean of the University of Massachusetts Nursing School was fired for the egregious crime of emailing the phrase, quote, "everyone's life matters." Sadly, the mainstream media fully supports the neoliberal revolution to overturn every tradition, every cultural tradition that have permitted some semblance of social cohesion that gave the U.S. meaning in the past. No matter how often the media is wrong, for example, the Vietnam War, the domino theory, if we don't get them there, they'll be on our doorsteps in California. Lies. Iraq's weapons of mass destruction, more lies. Russiagate, 4 years and counting of nothing but lies. 51 of the leading intelligence experts in the United States, including multiple former heads of the National Security Agency and the CIA, all gave a letter stating that it was Russia meddling in the midterms or in the 2020 election. And so there it goes. Well, what are we to make of this? They were all wrong, but no one apologized. No. And when Anthony Fauci made it very clear that schools should be closed, then 2 years later he says, "I never said that." We have his actual comments. And that has happened multiple times with multiple people who make one statement in COVID and then make a completely different statement later. "I didn't say that," or "I didn't believe that, even if I said it." Well, you're the most important person in this field, the head of the CDC, the head of the FDA, the head of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Disease. You mean you were walking around presupposing that America couldn't handle the truth, so you lied to us, but now you're telling us the truth? You lied about everything concerning COVID, including vaccines. Didn't you say that they've been tested for preventing viral infection and transmission? You could not broadcast virulent strains if you were given the vaccine. Then we just found out through one person, a president of one of Pfizer's divisions, when giving evidence under a COVID commission at the European Union, that no, we never tested for that. So when Rachel Maddow, with her specific type of highly aggressive behavior, said you must get the vaccine because if you do, you won't get COVID, you won't spread it, etc., I haven't heard any apologies. But everybody wants amnesty, but no apologies. And what about when they were broadcasting nightly extremely violent anti-racial street protest, but calling them peaceful, even as buildings were being burned in the background? We never hear the pundits apologize and correct their misreporting. It should not be a challengeable offense to speak out against why 34 million Americans being food insecure, including 9 million children. 9 million children is a lot of people. That's more people than live in New York City. And if you have every person in New York City plus an additional million who are food insecure, they just don't have enough food to eat in a day. And unfortunately, they're children. They can't go get a job. Where are they going to get food? And yet, it's on no one's to-do list. No one. Over a 500,000 people minimally are homeless, and 44 million don't have health insurance. It's not a conspiracy theory to place much of the blame for these dismal statistics on the government's incompetence and indifference. In his 1943 paper, A Theory of Human Motivation. Humanistic psychologist Abraham Maslow, M-A-S-L-O-W, outlined his theory of a hierarchical of need. For understanding the various levels of human motivation, now this is where it's going to get very interesting and take people to a door they have not opened before, with an understanding of why people will and will not engage in what is in their own best interest, or are afraid to challenge those who have used them and abused them. Maslow's belief that the apex of a fulfilled human life was to become self-actualized, which could be defined as an individual who has had all of his or her psychological, security, emotional, social, and personal esteem needs met. He believed that humans possessed an innate desire to be fulfilled and be all they could be. And this was possible within a healthy and productive social environment. Now, despite some flaws in Maslow's theory, it nevertheless may serve as a rudimentary template for understanding the moral and social collapse of American culture and values. In the 1940s, the majority of Americans, whether Democrat or Republican, were more conservative by today's standards. They were dependable, respectable, and had a strong desire to provide their children with more opportunities than they had, even if they, coming over as African Americans, or Italians, or Germans, or Irish, different groups, all were prejudiced against over periods of time. So they wanted more for their children. For the most part, they understood their place within the social hierarchy. They were at the bottom. But they did have pride in their heritage and made efforts to follow an ethical life. After the Second World War, and largely continuing through the 1970s, there was a social fragment that held American cities and towns together. In general, there was a gradual growth in prosperity and opportunities for families to move into the middle class. It was the first time that a large number of young people, myself included, could go to college, and there would be 3 jobs for every graduate. We didn't have credit cards, and rare was the person who had a mortgage, because people could have gotten a GI loan for 2% interest and built a home for $15,000 to about $25,000 after the Second World War, depending upon where it was. And then they worked hard to work that off. Merit in what you did was shown to have been a major step in developing character. And character was what people responded to, irrespective of your other attributes. It didn't matter if you were wealthy or had something that other people didn't have. People liked you because you were likable. People trusted you because your word meant something. People felt safe, so safe that they didn't even lock their homes or cars. I never remember anyone in my family locking a door, because it was accepted that no one's going to come in here because they shouldn't. It's a bad reflection upon them and their family. People cared about that. People cared about family. Many people cared about their religion, not in the practice of the religion as much as in the moral fiber that a religion provided. And it's interesting, if you study the different religions of the world, you'll see that virtually every religion holds certain basic tenets inviolate, and including moral standing, meaning, are you following a moral life? Are you being just? Are you being honest? Or are you trying to use people in ways that are immoral? And so there was a common community moral good. Members of a community collaborated together. Many people were satisfied to work in jobs that many today would find unbearable. Think of who would today go out and say, I'm going to spend the next 30 years working every day putting tires on cars in Flint, Michigan, or Detroit. The average person say, well, I don't want to do that. There's a whole lot more to life than doing that. But there was a time when that consistency, the worker be the what I call the adaptive supportive life energy, they were to adapt to the common good and they were there to show that they were going to be there for the long haul, frequently their whole lives, people respected the fact that they could recall the neighborhood and who had been there before them and their own family's heritage there, what generation they were and where they came from. We were indeed a melting pot. Was it always fair? No. Was there redlining? Yes. It was bias? Yes. But behind that, it was at least for about 40 years, it was an opportunity for us to find the meaning and purpose of our own existence to the degree we could. Senior citizens were not frowned on. They were revered because they were the wise men and women who had lived long enough to understand how not to make the mistakes that all of us who were young were inevitably going to make. But at least they were respected. Today, not at all. So this is a part of why Maslow's model worked, because people had their basic needs. Now, remember growing up, your parents at some point, I'm sure, talked to you about having a roof over your head, food on the table, clothes on your back, and enough money to be able to survive and appreciate what you had, and a good school where you actually learned reading, writing, math, geography. You learned about civics, and this prepared you for an advanced education, or if you didn't go to college, at least how to better adapt and survive in the society that you were going to be a part of. So when you see the masses not going out to protest, there's a reason why. One of the reasons why is that because already this group, and it's a large group, the largest group in our society, or in any society, has their basic, primal, and primary needs met. As long as they can say, I got a roof, I got a car, I got food in the fridge, I got clothes, I got a school, etc., got a job, I'm earning a living wage. People didn't make minimum wage when we were growing up. They made a living wage. And they prided themselves on that. Now, you can find flaws in every model, and I have found flaws in Maslow's model, but you have to look at everything in life without seeking perfection as your starting point. I never seek perfection. I seek balance, because perfection is something that we imagine happens, like looking at a beautiful field that Renoir, or one of the great painters of the 19th and 20th century, would have painted. And yet, as bucolic and beautiful it is, sit under a tree and see what happens when you get a tick bite. Now you got Lyme's disease. Everything is perfect until you get close enough to it to see its imperfections. And then you're disappointed because it was the perfection that you needed, you wanted, you desired. We see this in relationships where people overpromote the best that they can be, which is attractive to another person, especially someone seeking that, but then you get to see the rest of the person, and the rest of the person hasn't been balanced, so there's this big drop-off, this cliff. You thought, wow, how'd that happen? But it does. And a lot of what we're disappointed with in our society is how much of a classist society we've become. Your social status today is very meaningful. In fact, it's what a lot of people strive for. So if you're striving nonstop every day to get ahead, what do you have to sacrifice? Because every success today is a failure. You're just not looking at what is failing in your life because you're thinking, I'll get to it. Yeah, I'm going to work 75 hours a week, and my weekends, you know, I'm really not going to be there for the kids and my spouse and the dog, and those books are in the corner. I'll get to it. Yes, the proverbial, it'll be there when I'm ready for it. But we don't pay attention to what the Buddha said. You think you have time. You don't. And only when something crashes, when someone walks out and says, I'm leaving you. You once were a special person to me. But all that was special is gone. You've sacrificed this on the altar of your insecurity, which is manifested in the duality of narcissism and massive drive with your ego. So you're feeding your ego and your self-image instead of feeding your soul. Because at the end of the day, all healing must begin at the spiritual level. And then it reverberates up as an energy transformation into the rest of the body. And yet in our society, we're doing just the opposite. We have an enormous class of people that used to be essential and were part of the glue that held a society together. We all knew our family doctors. The doctor never said, what's your symptoms? Here's a drug. Never. They would sit with you patiently. They would want to know, how you doing? How you doing in school? Oh, and if Timothy back then, well, Timmy's not doing well in all the classes. What's wrong? I don't know. Doctor said it's a brain chemical imbalance. Well, that's nonsense. There's no such thing as a brain chemical imbalance unless it's caused by the drugs. Is Timmy the same in every class? Let's ask him. Timmy, are you happy in all the classes? No. How many classes don't you like? Well, I don't like one of the teachers, and I don't like two of the other classes. They're boring. So your mind wanders, you look out the window, you fidget, you blurt out answers, you go to the bathroom a lot. Yes. Well, that's not a brain chemical imbalance. That's not ADHD. That's simply the environment in a classroom is not as exciting as one that a person can create outside the room unless there's a teacher they like. And how are you doing at home? Oh, Timothy does great at home. No problem. So what an interesting disease he has, and 10 million other children. They have it in certain classes, but not in all classes. They have it in certain places, but not all places. Could you just imagine walking into a hospital and say, something's going wrong in my life today and I'm not happy. Oh, you have cancer. Okay. But I'm feeling good today on the next day. Oh, you have no cancer. Okay. Well, you can't turn cancer on and off, have it, not have it. It doesn't work that way. And yet think of all the people at one time would have known that and would have tried to seek the real progenitor, the real basis of your problem and fix it at that level. You would have had your teachers, your principal, your parents, your in-laws, all involved in trying to help you. Today, it's a pill. And the people pushing that pill are the professional class. Pushing the wrong curriculum, the professional class. Pushing the wrong place to put your money, the professional class. Polluting our environment, the professional class. Over-designed structures that destroy the environment but take no responsibility for it, the professional class. Who have more kids who are strung out on more drugs, committing suicide, living in the bubbles, the professional class. Now, we've always had people of different backgrounds. We've always had architects and scientists and professors, lawyers and engineers. But for a long time, they did not feel that they had to be separate from everyone else. We attended the same schools. We went to the same lawn parties and cover dish dinners. We cared about each other. And when that began to change, because the people began to care more about their own needs and less about societal needs, and that's what separated. So you're not going to see ever the large mass of Americans protesting anything, because they have Maslow's first element. Unless they become poverty-stricken and no longer have a middle-class background, they're going to remain silent, but for reasons I'm trying to explain. But then there are other issues with Maslow's model. Yes, they had the basic needs of food, but a lot of people don't, and shelter. A lot of people have had their homes removed from them. Economic and health security. A lot of people are not economically healthy financially, and they're certainly not healthy with their, we're the sickest we've ever been, in part because people are so stressed because of the uncertainty of the policymakers' decisions and how it will impact them. And yet we don't see this. We don't discuss it ever. As a result, that only leaves them with love and meaningful relationships in their families, neighbors. Why do you think that for the first time in Italy's history, a woman was elected president? And yesterday, there were 300,000 Italians in the streets saying, stop giving money and weapons to Ukraine, mainly weapons. when we have a country that has been so neglected and so crime-ridden that we are suffering, and we have way above a 9% inflation rate. It's closer to 14%. So they're in the streets. Why? Because the sanctity of the family, the sanctity of the basics, being able to share love and joy and meaningful relationships in a secure environment has been challenged. And because it's been challenged, they're going to the streets. Why? Because in France and in Italy, in Spain, they've grown up with a different tradition where not to trust authority as much as we've trusted authority in the United States. So even when a person knows that what you're doing is wrong, unless they feel their life energy allows them to stand up and say, you're wrong, you're dangerous, what you're offering is leading us into the abyss, they will rather turn on television and be distracted. So there are good reasons why you're not going to see change. And perhaps the turning point arrived with the rise of junk bond kings and financial villains. Predatory capitalism was discovered to be exceedingly profitable, and the markets increasingly became more rigged in favor of Wall Street. Now, mind you, we went through children were brought in from Poland, let's say, and when they got in through they got through Ellis Island in their checkup, they would have a card sewed onto their jacket, and it would say Katanning, Pennsylvania. And when they got to shore, there would be people who would from Katanning and from the coal companies who would usher all those people on that train that have a list of who is coming onto a train, take them down there, put them in barracks, and then they would be charged rent. They would be charged food for their food, which was meager, and they'd be worked nearly to death. Why? Because the Carnegies, the Mellons, the Square Engines, the Hills, the Goulds, the Rockefellers, the Morgans, all of these robber barons made their money by robbing the natural resources and exploiting the people to the degree they could get away with it. But then, thank goodness, in came unions and people to stop this exploitation of child labor and early death. And who was one of the worst villains? Andrew Carnegie. And he owned U.S. Steel. When he sold it, he was probably the second wealthiest man in America behind J.D. Rockefeller, Sr. And he then felt guilt. He began to give money to Carnegie University and Carnegie Libraries and Carnegie Foundation. So he began to give a lot of his money away. Okay, good for him for giving money away that you no longer needed, but it was how you made it that was something you can't take back. You can't take back all the children's lives that were working in coal mines and developing black lung by the age of 11 or 12, who had no future. So you have to understand, you must also judge a society on who built it and what suffering they went through in order for someone one day to lord over everyone and say, defer to me because I am the one. I hold the golden ring and no one else does. And then others did. And then there were small groups and they all were friends. And they all worked together. No different than Klaus Schwab and others today. You didn't elect them. You didn't give them the rights over what your future should be. But they are so filled with manifest destiny that they believe they have the right to do with you as they want. And they will. Nothing's going to stop them unless we see something in human nature change, but we are highly adapted. We have been programmed, all based upon controlling us. And so we give the favor over to Wall Street, to the high-rolling investors. We give it over to the chemical companies and the big pharma because they tell us these drugs will save our lives. They never look at the consequences and how many lives they take. In America today, we have failed at the important level that we reward people for their efforts but never take a look at the results. If we did, we would ask for a do-over. So it was a time when a certain new class in the 1970s of dynamic and aggressive individuals became leaders in industries and finance were under their control. They wanted to make money off money. Now, historically, if you were the head of a steel company and you lived in Pittsburgh, you might have the biggest house in town, but everyone in that town knew that you were the solidifying factor that held that all that together. Therefore, for generations, people had lived and worked in the industry, and you provided them with a standard of living, even though you were compelled to. It wasn't voluntary. But now you are not held back. Why do you want to live in Pittsburgh? Why do you want to live in Detroit? Why do you want to live in Camden? Why do you want to live in Compton when you can live on Park Avenue? How do I got to get there? Simple. Sell your company. Besides, with all these unions and all their health care and environmental policies, think of how much cheaper you can make steel if you made it in, let's say, China. They'll find another job. Okay, I went to Camden. I've been to these towns. I went to Detroit. And even though it was in the mid-1970s when a lot of this started, they didn't find another job to replace the one they had, and therefore their whole sense of security was threatened. Remember, people need to feel a secure sense of stability in their lives that can later be transformed into purpose and meaning. Yet following the destruction of Maslow's second fundamental need for security, the third need is for family, community, relationships, religion, and a sense of belonging begins to deteriorate, and then everything becomes uncertain. And that's where people make bad choices, because they feel desperate. They're not a policymaker, they're not an opinion leader, nobody cares about them. The media doesn't focus upon what it's like living when you can only afford one meal a day for your family. They don't care. This trend started in the 1980s and reached an accelerated speed during the Clinton years. Yes, you can thank Bill Clinton and his wife and all the people Al Gore around them for creating this, because they were young, they were ruthless, they were restless, they were driven, and they were selected before they were elected. They could do anything and get away with it. Just look at his background in Little Rock, Arkansas. But nobody wants to look there. Nobody wants to open up that door. Because if you did, you wouldn't like what you saw. And you say, well, how in the world did someone with this lack of scruples end up in the most powerful position in the world? Because the people who knew that they could control him or her. Major cities and towns were increasingly abandoned by their dynamic and creative leaders, notably Detroit and St. Louis, Cleveland, Buffalo, and Pittsburgh. These five cities alone would lose over half of their population due to the erosion of their economic job base in immigration to places where at least they could find a job. And this is as free trade agreements kicked in, where they weren't free to the unionists who were betrayed by their unions, top and bottom. But then again, why didn't they throw the union leaders out? Because once again, we have this fetish in the United States of, if you're not the expert, then you're not the power. If you're not the power, then you're not to be deferred to. If you can't be deferred to, then what use are you? Get in line and take a ticket and wait your turn to ask a question. So we all are trying, if you're one of the people in the professional movement, all trying to become deferred to. Why? Because when you're deferred to because you're the top person in your field or one of the top, then you're relevant. And maintaining social relevance, financial relevance, political relevance, entertainment relevance is the real engine that drives them. That's not something spiritual. That's why so few people who become successful stop and say, I've been blessed by having the success provide me with an opportunity to help those who are not as fortunate, to share my gifts with others, and at the same time continue my education about life. Very few people have I ever met that I've counseled who are willing to stop once they had success and start growing and sharing. It was just more gluttony, more ego grooming, and surrounding yourself with emotional leeches. And so the average person was watching all this. Life became a spectator sport. Today there are now a billionaire class that will no longer have allegiance to a country or a culture or a religion. They don't care about any of that. Do you really think anyone in power cares about whether you're red or blue? They don't, because they control it. They're above that. They are the transnationalist who perceive the entire world as their playground to exploit, to rape, to submit to their economic shackles through international banking systems and the Western governments, foreign ministries that serve to advance private interest. They have the freedom to create their own rules regardless of the public's welfare. This provides a level of confidence and heightened self-esteem, Maslow's fourth hierarchical need. So if you're not able to get that self-esteem where you work, if you're a school teacher or you're a mason, a plumber, if you're a bookkeeper, your self-esteem is going to come by being a good person, a loving person that people enjoy being with. You brighten their life. And when you're in a room, they feel warm by that presence. But that's the majority of people who are never asked for anything except their allegiance. We're talking about the professional class, the single most lethal class in American history. These people, wow. What can I say? They are so focused on Maslow's hierarchical progression that they will say and do anything in order to maintain their relevance. Financial relevance, buy what you can't afford, but work hard enough to exploit your patients or whoever you're working with so that you can pay for it. It's a different hierarchical order whereby a distorted self-esteem becomes an opiate. Moreover, similar to Freud and the later generation of behavioralists after James Watson, Maslow failed to observe that not everyone is the same if they reach the same level of placement in society. Not every doctor is a good doctor. People have a variety of motivations, and yet they follow different rituals and beliefs. The new globalist elite are indifferent with social and national collapse and chaos and seem to have no reservations to enable its pace to increase. For example, in Michigan, a law was passed that permits, goes into effect January 1st, that permits anyone to break into your private home and stay there. You cannot touch them. You cannot have them arrested. The intruders can stay there as long as they choose, and you can't do a damn thing about it. In New York, hundreds of thousands of people have left, including the very favored Upper West Side. The greatest group of intellectuals and successful people in the world history lived between 57th and Broadway and 120th and Broadway from Riverside Drive and the Hudson River over to Central Park West. Why did they leave? Well, I can tell you. They left because of crime. They left because there was no longer safety and stability. In their apartments there was. But what about when they used to go for a walk and down Broadway or go for, you know, a walk in Central Park or Riverside Park? Now they do so without knowing, will I be victimized or not? Why? Because criminals have been given a revolving door purely for political reasons, ideological reasons, from the court. As a result, there is no deterrence to their committing crimes of any type. They know they'll be able to return to the streets because of the ideologists in power, sponsored by one of the most influential policymakers that never is in a debate, but his minions are the people who take his money, George Soros. Again, Maslow hierarchy topples as the law-abiding populace lives in constant fear and angst, especially those who are the professional class. Now they feel, hold on a second, I'm spending $4 million on this apartment. My kid, one kid's going to Harvard, one kid's going to Yale, one kid's going to Stanford. I can't just let them stay in a dormitory. Then that would be as if they were just like everyone else. So no, I've got to buy a co-op for each one of them or apartment. So I'm having to spend a lot of money. I got to make at least $3 million a year, every year, in order to keep up this spending. I see. And I thought the Upper West Side was perfect. The gourmet restaurants and the boutiques and the clean streets and the safe neighborhoods. I see. Did you ever go to Bed-Stuy to see what it's like to live there? Did you see that they don't have the same clean or safe streets? Did you do anything to try to change that? Did you bring your power, your authority, whatever it may be, to a city council meeting saying, why aren't we looking at every borough and every street as if they were all equal in the need to maintain safety and quality of life on that street? Well, that's not my interest. I don't care about that. Oh, you don't care about that. No, I only cared about myself, my family. So now we're leaving. Okay. Just look at the people living in Los Angeles, New York, and Chicago, to states that are less restrictive, safer, and more open. When we consider Maslow's fifth level of self-actualization, this is where his theory was short-sighted. Maslow's ideal of a fulfilling life was closer to Plato's vision of what is known as eudaimonia, or genuine well-being and happiness, which is a state of being independent of transitory hedonic pleasures and essential survival needs. For example, for Plato, genuine happiness cannot be acquired by stimulation from the external. So no matter what you think is going to make your life better, if you buy it, own it, and can show it, that's an illusion. It is not a part of the objective world. Rather, it is a state of inner contempt that you don't have everything you need in order to justify your position. Well, that means you're going to have to cultivate an introspection that you currently don't use. In our postmodern society, self-actualization is nothing less than another form of hedonic self-aggrandizement. The ruling elite of government and industry perceive themselves as independent from society altogether. Yes, their isolation is misinterpreted as some kind of self-fulfillment. Since they have reached the top of the pyramid, they have the financial means, the social acceptance, the political acknowledgement that you're somebody. Come into our club. As a result, they live in a perverted utopia built upon accumulated wealth and celebrity status, rather than serving as the financial stabilizer of society, they're its destroyers. Rather than act as privileged neighbors with the means to uplift communities, they live in manicured green zones for the rich and powerful, protected all from the commoner, who they view as potential barbarians at the gate. I want to say goodbye to our WBA audience. You're going to the news, and we're going to go to the top of the hour on PRN.live. And listen tonight, 7 o'clock, I will have one of the most interesting conversations with a medical doctor, a woman who began to see problems in how medicine was practiced, how diagnosis was being done. And she has got a lot to say. 7 o'clock, PRN.fm. So these new people climbing this social Darwinian ladder, the lawyers, the doctors, the consultants, the scientists, the professors, the media personalities, the actors and actresses, all making more than the average person, but then having to show the world what they own and how exclusive is their world. They no longer want to live beside the people they grew up with and the neighbors they grew up with, because that reminds them their incompleteness. They want to show their stuff. They want to buy the bling. They want to buy the cars. They want to buy the houses, the private jets. They want to show you the type of alcohol they can drink at $700 a bottle. They want to show you that they deserve your attention, your respect. It's all an illusion. They are the modern-day version of Gordon Gekko and the mantra that greed is good. Gordon. And for the 16 million professional class, who's it good for? Is it good for the patient that doesn't have insurance but has cancer, and the oncologist is charging them for the therapy, charging them for every minute they're with them and every treatment they get, but then do they tell the patient, we're going to the manufacturers? Because in our profession, in oncology, we've managed to be allowed to buy the drugs that we're giving, chemotherapy, at cost, and then mark it up at full retail, and insurance will pay, and then you'll pay, and that's why you're going to have a $400,000 bill before you get your flowers and decide whether it's cremation or funeral. Normal burial. I see. What if you just looked at your profession to see what's wrong with my profession? Why are we still allowing 500,000 to 600,000 people a year, or up to 600,000, die of cancer? And we've made very little progress. What can we do different? No. They're not going to do that because they're the Gordon Geckos of oncology, but we have it in cardiology and neurology. We have it in banking. We have it in food production. We have it in media. We have it in sports. How good is he as an athlete? Well, I don't know, but he's making he just signed a $125 million contract. He must be very good then. No, there's no relationship between what a person's paid and their ultimate performance. What we have is we have, as a society, an entire, virtually complete inversion of a genuine moral character. They only look at the height of their ladder and the spectrum of earthly achievement, the mansion, the yachts, who they're invited to have dinner with, how many times they can walk the red carpet. Their lives are always uneasy and crave more hedonic satisfaction. Their kingdoms are stolen without public coronation, exemplified by the Davos crowd, who believe they are authorized, like Bono, to control billions of lives without any electoral process. And as we passively observe the elite becoming richer and the powerful becoming more powerful, the social fabric that holds communities together frays and then rips apart, because those people were so trusting and so obedient and so passively adaptable that they've been waiting all along for things to get better or to return to normal, neither of which is ever going to happen again. Then there's the professional class, the well-educated, who support the elite and comprise approximately 18% of the population, who want to be wealthy and desire to sit at the decision-making table in their field. They won't contribute to any constructive change because they are too disconnected from the average person's authentic needs. They are preoccupied with their own needs and therefore frequently ruthless towards others. All the while, the media and entertainment industries have been profoundly bewitched by the elite's globalist dystopia. The penetration of reality shows has imported the worst of human nature into our living rooms. We witness envy, greed, jealousy, vindictiveness, and cheering audiences. Everything that an earlier religious upbringing warned against is glorified in its full display. With very few exceptions, there is no longer anything redeeming in American entertainment. Andy Warhol is believed to have predicted in the future everyone will, in the world, will be famous for 15 minutes, end quote. Although untrue, it doesn't stop the narcissistic from seeking unearned relevance. From our television screens and computer monitors, a faux celebrity mindset now dominates social media, such as YouTube, TikTok, and Instagram. Among the 10 highest YouTube earners for 2021 was 24-year-old Jimmy Donaldson, who goes by the pseudonym of Mr. Beast. Donaldson has captured 3 billion views and earned $54 million. That is more than the highest paid professional basketball player at $48 million. Mr. Beast's sole goal is to double his figures. What made this seeming perpetual Peter Pan so popular? Simple. Moronic stunts, such as freezing himself in ice, running around the Ferris wheel 1,000 times, and constructing the largest Lego tower. If this is indicative of how low entertainment has fallen, we should not be surprised at the epidemic of depression, anxiety, and angst raging in the country. The American psyche is broken beyond repair. It is therefore not surprising that the World Economic Forum's self-empowerment guru, Yuval Harari, receives high praise from Obama and Clinton and the global elite when he declares that the majority of humans are, quote, useless eaters. The globalist solution is slow depopulation, addict the unskilled population that you've made unskilled by replacing them with transhumanism, robotics, artificial intelligence, to the soma of a strap-on head machine that can entertain you until you die. This is a hard proposition, but is nevertheless a solution being fervently debated among Klaus Schwab's new globalist elites, such as Bill Gates, Al Gore, BlackRock's Larry Fink, and many other Western businesses and government leaders, Justin Trudeau. If we simply wait for a sufficient number of Americans to awake from their stupor to proactively protest in force, we may as well sit on a toadstool and wait for Godot. It won't happen. There are countless issues Americans have a legitimate need to protest. Unfortunately, the professional class is irredeemably complacent. Physicians daily witness pharmaceutical and surgical price gouging, bankrupting their patients, yet they are silent. Never a demonstration at the national level of doctors, not one. Nurses, not one. Dentists, not one. Yet they are all silent. Across American university campuses, professors and administrators know full well that outrageously overpriced education fees are putting students into perpetual college loan debt. Tens of thousands of them could go to the streets, hundreds of thousands, even millions. There's never been a universal protest to state Princeton, Harvard, Yale, New York University, we believe that you're overpriced in your tuition. Bring it down and forgive the student debt. Not one. We should have all the students who are compromised by this student debt because not all their parents are rich and can pay for it, and some will be in debt peonage for decades. There should be a universal student protest. Don't go into a classroom until the tuition changes and the debt is forgiven. There's not been one. There hasn't been a protest on Wall Street. There hasn't been a protest in the food industry. Nor there hasn't been a protest, unless it's something about school teachers who didn't protest anything until they were forced to suddenly lose their job or get vaccinated. And then suddenly they found their mouth, but only a small group. But the rest did not protest, and you cannot expect them to. Journalists have never protested en masse about how controlled the media is and how the stories they would never do if they were independent, they have to do. Publish or go away. And nobody working in the arms industry will speak out against the blood money that lucrative careers depend upon. So, in conclusion, is there any hope that there may be the emergence of a new revolutionary American ethos? The power elites have succeeded in balkanizing and splintering the U.S. landscape with too many warring factions fighting over their pet ideologies and personal ambitions. There is no unity, ergo, a concerted populist offensive is unlikely. Collapse and decay lie ahead as the masses rush towards erecting their individual illusionary utopias, all the while unknowingly fueling a certain dystopia. I'm Gary Nall. Thank you for listening. This article will appear today on GaryNall.com. Now stay tuned for Utrecht Lead.